Hi, this is Nicholas Webb, the author of Chaotic Change. Welcome to the Chaotic Change Masterclass. The purpose of this class is to turn my listeners and my readers into chaotic change makers. And in a time of crazy change, that's a good thing. Now, before we get started, I want to point out a little bit about the way in which we have structured this masterclass program. Now, the truth of the matter is, most masterclass programs are really a way in which organizations try to find sales leads. And so there is nothing in this program to try to sell you anything. So this is just pure content that is designed to deliver actionable takeaways that you can apply immediately in your job or within your enterprise. The other thing that I know is that leaders really ingest content primarily through audiobooks. The data proves it. So if we're going to do a change maker program, why not make it as an audio program so that we can make it transportable and really deliver it in a way in which the listener wants to receive content? Now, lastly, we're using a method called nano learning. And really what that means is that we take just high content density. In other words, the stuff you actually need to know, and we deliver that without any other kind of wasted time. In other words, we strip away all of the wasted content and give you just actionable insights that you can apply. So we've pulled out the stories, the anecdotes, the whatevers, to give you stuff that you can actually use. So I hope you appreciate this approach. I really put a lot of thought into how could I best deliver this content in a way that was comfortable, easy, and that had the highest degree of content retention. And that's the reason why I've taken this approach. Okay, well, listen, let's get started. The program I've created here is really 5 modules. And the modules look at the first thing, which is leadership. And the information around leadership comes from my best-selling book entitled Lucid Leadership. And so we're going to go into what does it mean to lead in a time of hyper-complexity? What does it mean to become clear as a leader? And why is that so important today? We've talked about leadership styles and leadership this and that. But you know, the truth of the matter is the fundamental requirement for great leaders today is clarity. We'll go into that in some detail in our first module. Then we're going to talk a little bit about the impact of emerging technologies. Now, obviously, this is a dynamic area, and I'll try to keep it within, you know, a 5-year trajectory of where we're heading with technology, just to make sure it's near earth enough that you can apply these new technologies within your organization to drive growth, happiness, and prosperity. That's what this is really all about. Then we're going to talk about hyper-consumerism. You know, look, it doesn't matter if you're a B2B business or if you're a B2C business or anything in between. We all have customers, right? Fundamentally, what we do in business is we get stuff, whether that's a service or a product, and we sell stuff. But the expectations of customers have changed dramatically. And the way in which we get better insights about what customers want, the way we invent above their baseline level of expectation, and the way in which we delight customers to drive predictable revenue growth is really so important today in a time of hyper-complexity and fast-moving markets. Then we're going to go into the 4th module, which is really about workforce and staffing. I mean, look, if there's anything that's chaotic, it's the way in which we attract, retain, inspire employees, right? That's changed completely. But the problem is most of the ideas around staffing and most of the ideas around all things workforce are just wrong. So I'm going to leverage insights from my best-selling book, Happy Work, to talk about what the best organizations in the world are doing to attract and retain mission-critical talent. This is really important. Because remember, everything that we do, everything within our organization is people-powered. But we almost look at people incidentally. The other thing is that if we're going to address module 3, consumerism, we have to address module 4, the new workforce. It turns out that unhappy employees deliver really bad customer experiences. And conversely, bad customer experiences really torture employees. We have to move on to what we call the new method, which is human experience innovation. It's a really exciting area, and it works with mathematical certainty. And in one fell swoop, you build a culture of happiness for both employees, partners, and ultimately customers. All right. Then we're going to wrap up this with the innovation mandate, module 5. We're going to talk about innovation in a very practical way. You know, I've been writing books and talking about innovation for 40 years, my entire career. I started out as an innovator and have been awarded over 40 patents for technology. So I understand innovation in a very practical way. I've set up centers for innovations for universities and corporations. But if we're going to do this right, we have to kind of watch out about the noise that's out there around innovation, because I find, interestingly enough, that it's virtually all wrong. We want to be able to leverage the superpower, especially of enterprise innovation, to significantly improve the returns on our goals. That's what's really exciting about enterprise innovation, is that we can get a 60% better return on stated strategic priorities when we do this stuff right. Look, this program is about the things that you need to care about the most in the next 5 years. I was very, very careful to make certain that I created a curriculum for this program that was the most germane for the things that we have to address right now. In my strategic consulting practice, we track with our Trend GPS program over 500 market trends. And these that are in this program today are the trends that are always rising to the top of our analysis of the things that organizations need to worry about. Okay, one few more things before we get started here. You know, I think it's important to know who this program is for. I think this program is particularly well suited to boards of directors, CEOs, high-level executives, departmental leaders, and managers, because all of this applies across all of those disciplines. And I think that I have put this together in a way that really uses a vernacular that makes sense for those job titles. As far as industry, I do a lot of work in healthcare and technology fields, but this stuff is available to really anybody that wants to be able to drive predictable growth, to be able to be future ready, and to really build an organization that is spectacular. So it's really not industry specific. Although we tend to live in really, really tough, complicated markets. So if it works for them, I know it'll work for you. You know, it also, I think, is very valuable to entrepreneurs and startups to understand these advanced concepts as they begin to develop more strategic sophistication and more managerial sophistication. We can kind of help jumpstart that. All right. Now, without further ado, let's start out with Module 1. Lucid Leadership. Again, this is from my best-selling book, Lucid Leadership. Here's what we found. In researching the best organizations and the best leaders in the world, we have seen that there was a lot of discussion about servant leadership and all of these other new methods, and those are all fine. But I think, let's use a little common sense here. What does it mean to be a leader? Well, it means that you have to be the expert in the room, right? You need to know what's going on in the outside world. You need to have a clear understanding of your own culture. And listen, all of the best leaders in the world, without a doubt, are incredibly self-aware. So it turns out, and I feel this with great certainty because I have a very busy strategic practice, what I am seeing in a very practical way is that the leaders that have people that want to follow them, the leaders that are driving predictable enterprise growth and are getting far better returns on stated priorities, those leaders are lucid leaders. Now, lucidity is just another word for clarity. They're clear. Now, let's talk about the three dimensions of clarity. First is what I call marketscape clarity. Well, what's marketscape? Is that a made-up word? I don't know. Maybe. Marketscape really looks at something that goes beyond marketplace. The marketscape, think of it as the landscape of the marketplace. Marketscape clarity means that you understand competitive analysis. You know who your competition is. You know what the key trends are within your marketplace, without a doubt. You're very clear on the things that need to be done in terms of the standard mechanics of the outside world. Although I will say that most leaders are not particularly clear on the marketplace, let alone the marketscape. Marketscape leaders understand the impact of all external and internal trends. And by that I mean they understand the impact of artificial intelligence, robotic process automation, changing workforce. They understand the trajectory of change. So they're really, in many ways, futurists within their own industry. They see the trajectory of change, and they're obsessed with it. Not just the marketplace, but everything that surrounds the marketplace. What about the political ether? What about reimbursement? What about other economic trends? What about? These are the things that lucid leaders obsess over. They obsess over understanding the net totality of all things outside their building. Now, it may sound like that's going to be a pretty tough goal to be able to be uber clear about the outside world. Here's what we have found in coaching top leaders and top brands is that you first have to decide that it makes sense for you to pay attention to what's outside your building. Believe it or not, we develop organizations that are so internal centric. We're so focused on our systems, our tools, our processes, our methods, our strategies, our people, our, that we really don't have much emotional or intellectual bandwidth to take a look outside the world to find out what the heck's going on or what we're going to do about it. So I would have to say that 90% of becoming a lucid leader begins with a commitment to clarity. Now, let me give you a relationship example. Now, I've been married for 32 years, and I practiced something very early on when my kids were really young. I have four kids. And when I would come home from a day's work, I would walk into the house, and this was well known, they expected it, and I would drop to the carpet, drop my briefcase, and I would drop to the floor. My kids were at that time 2 and 3 and 6 years old. But I would spend hours getting to understand their world and how to interact with them and to learn from them and to, well, enjoy the experience with my kids. It's what my kids later referred to as carpet time. Carpet times means living the experience of the outside world. What's it like in our customers' world? How can we develop more thoughtful and collaborative relationships with vendors and other key partners? It begins with a desire and a belief that clarity is important. And I have to say that the overwhelming majority, certainly the failing leaders, are not even at that emotional state yet. That's shocking to me. So here we go. External is your first three pillars of clarity. And it's something you simply have to make a commitment for. Do you at any time know what is necessary to know about the outside world? The answer is a resounding no. And the problem with infinity is there's just too much of it. And that's what's outside your brick building. Infinity. It's unending. It's hyper-complicated. What I found about this blur of complexity that lives outside of our organization is that when we lean into the blur, we begin to understand the order of the blur. We see the levers and the dashboard and the knobs. We begin to understand how to operate within inside this amorphous blob of chaotic change. You can't understand it unless you engage it. And the overwhelming majority of leaders recoil away from change. It's so frustrating because it's fun out there. I hate to use the F word, but learning what's going on outside your building is a blast. And most importantly, it is the ultimate way that you as a leader can serve your enterprise, and for that matter, your career. Okay, there it is. Dimension one, understand the marketscape, everything that lives outside your world, not just market data. Now, here's another one that's surprising, shocking, but very few leaders have reached a leadership level of maturity to have cultural clarity. It's amazing to me when I interview a CEO that is having problems in terms of presenteeism and returns on strategy. They're always telling me that the team loves them and that they're out there doing what they need to do and everybody's happy and things are great. But when I interview in confidence under a non-disclosure agreement, in other words, I agree with the employee to never tell their boss anything they're telling me. So they are absolutely 100% open to me because I will honor that. I will absolutely not directly share what one person said. What I find is that they're saying, you know, our boss is clueless. We've asked them to change the shipping methods at Jarvik 9 Center and they've ignored us. We've told them that it was a really bad idea to go from a 6-minute maximum waiting time to a 15-minute waiting time. Sales plummeted, but they still ignored us. They're not listening to us. They don't know what it's like here. And no, we're not happy working at XYZ Corporation. It's tough to be able to have the level of self-esteem and fortitude and integrity to really care enough about what the people inside your organization believe and feel. Now, we're going to talk a lot more about workforce and staffing later, but I want to point out that understanding the cultural temperature requires that you create a safe place to innovate. Encourage smart risk-taking. Allow people to criticize systems and tools and processes and policies. Create a culture of openness, of true collaboration and ideation. One of the things I do a great deal with unbelievable success. In fact, we have created tens of millions of dollars in enterprise value for our clients by conducting happiness hackathons. One of the best ways to find out what the cultural temperature is to get a team together and to say, look, here's the rule. You cannot say anything here today that will adversely impact your career pathway. So as we go into this hackathon, you will not be punished for sharing your authentic ideas about what's right and what's wrong. Then we use some interesting linguistics. We say we're going to use some language here today where we want you each to put together a list of the 10 things you hate, yes, I said it, hate most about XYZ Corporation. Then, we're going to talk about the 10 things that you love about XYZ Corporation. What I find is when I compare what we get out of these hackathons, which are facilitated, meaning there's some other rules to conducting a good hackathon, and you break them up in groups and you develop, you know, employee personifications. There's other stuff you can do to make this right. The point that I'm making is when I compare employee survey data, which is always horrible and wrong in my opinion, to the data that we get in the hackathon, wow, what a difference. We get authentic, genuine, and most importantly, actionable insights. We're not just saying, yes, it's okay to work here. Well, what does that mean? What do you mean okay? Why isn't it great? And what can you do to help us make it great? Let's talk about ideas. Remember that the idea of a hackathon is you lock yourself in the room and you leave there with better insights, but not just better insights, you're leaving there with innovations. You're going to fix stuff that makes them hate you, and you're going to bolster stuff that makes them love you. And I will say that virtually always this is free. It's free. This is consulting advice at its very best because you're collaborating with problem, opportunity, and customer-facing stakeholders. They are the true experts. In fact, I hate to admit this, this might be a consulting secret, but when I go into an organization, all I do is talk to the amazing people that show up every day to serve that organization's missions. And I say, what do you hate here? What's broken? What can we fix? If we were to give you the authority to do this today, what would that look like? It's amazing, the economic value that comes out of that. But there's another aspect of that. When we get that great insights, we let that stakeholder know that they actually matter. And when they understand that they matter because we're asking them their opinion, wow, it gets really, really exciting. They love to be asked. In fact, one of the key ways to improve quality of work life is to collaborate with employees so that they can create a linkage between their own themness with the goals of the enterprise. So again, cultural clarity is critical. It requires a willingness to be authentic, to be approachable, to create a safe space to innovate, to create an environment that encourages courage. You do that as a leader, you are a chaotic change maker, and you are an innovation superstar. Now, here's the third dimension of leadership clarity. Self-awareness. Self-awareness. Oh, good old self-awareness, right? This is a tough one because we all struggle with our ability to really be self-aware, to understand our strengths and our weaknesses. And most importantly, in the area of leadership, to understand the way in which we're able to inspire and impact other people. This is something that we all work on our entire lifetime. But I think the ability to collaborate with individuals within your team and within your organization, to ask them some tough questions. Do you feel that I present myself in a respectful way to the team? Do you feel like I have an openness towards listening to other ideas? Do you feel like I have rigidity in my thinking and policies? What would be the three areas that you believe that I could improve? What would you do differently if you were doing my job? Those kinds of questions are incredibly powerful. I mean, first of all, think about that from the perspective of an employee, to have their boss, their leader, ask them questions like that. I mean, wow, that really shows somebody right off the bat that has a pathway towards great self-clarity. Because if we're not clear on our impact, if we're not clear on how we're perceived, if we're not clear on how we're able to motivate and inspire the individuals that serve our mission every day, then we're not going to be a good leader. Leadership requires more than just understanding the mechanics of the policies of the organization. In a time of hyper-complexity, in a time of the great talent drought, the best leaders in the world are lucid leaders. Okay, so by way of review, in order to lead in a time of chaotic change, the best leaders are really good across the three dimensions of leadership clarity. Number one, they go beyond just understanding the marketplace. They understand all of the complexity of the market scape, the landscape of everything that will impact their organization in every possible way. Pillar number two, they understand their culture. They have true cultural clarity. They collaborate, they co-create, they innovate, they create safe spaces for their teams. And as a result of that, these organizations attract and retain the best talent. These organizations have significantly higher degrees of presenteeism and employee productivity. And that, of course, results in a higher degree of return on human capital. The bottom line is that you do a much better job as a leader when you're clear on your culture. Lastly, I've always found that the best leaders are astonishingly self-aware. It's incredible. It's astonishing. They are self-aware. They really get it. They know what their limits are. They know where their capabilities and strengths are. They understand the way in which they are perceived by the people they engage. And they're incredibly good listeners and very, very empathetic, thoughtful, honest. And as a result of that, their life is amazing, and the work that they do for their enterprise is beautiful. Okay, so that concludes our first module, leadership Leadership is important, and I put it first because it's something that we all have to make sure we're good at if we want to be able to transition into this time of hyperspeed, big changes, and the amorphous nature of change. We've got to be great leaders, and we have to be clear on what's going on. This is probably the most important point I'd like to make in this entire program, although there's some other good stuff. All right, let's move into module two, the impact of emerging technologies and, of course, artificial intelligence. As we transition through the next 5 years, we are going to see astonishing changes in the way in which we can manage, leverage, and serve our enterprise if we are willing to understand the technology. And it's interesting. I find that a lot of leaders aren't necessarily technophobic, but they're also not technology open in many ways, right? So the key is that, you know, we really are in, I don't care what your business is. I mentioned this at a keynote presentation I did for the healthcare industry. I said that hospitals are technology companies that, oh yeah, happen to deliver safe and efficacious patient care. And that offended a lot of people. They're saying, well, wait a minute, I'm a doctor. I'm the key to healthcare. I'm an ER nurse. I'm the key to healthcare. Well, of course, they are incredibly important but how good would they be without the ability to have access to technology? In fact, my best friend is a orthopedic surgeon. He was on an airplane and one of the passengers suffered a heart attack. And of course, the flight attendant said, is there a doctor in the house? And he looked around, hoping that somebody else would raise their hand. And nope, it was him. So he raises his hand, goes over, and the patient was in serious cardiac crisis. He didn't have a defibrillator. He didn't have any diagnostic tools. He really wasn't an emergency doctor or a cardiologist for that matter. But his biggest concern, he said, is, I wish I would have had just some basic medicines and some basic tools, and I could have rendered aid in a far better way. Luckily, the patient survived, but it was close. So how good is he as a doctor without the technology? He admitted that the technology is centerpiece to the way in which he delivers safe and efficacious care. It's also critical to the way in which we deliver enterprise results. So there's a few things that we need to do in a time of chaotic change. Number one, we have to reduce costs. We have to reduce costs. We're seeing tremendous price sensitivity, hyper-competition, all kinds of things that tell us that we need to control and manage cost. Well, first of all, I think we should be looking at robotic process automation. Robotic process automation is a range of solutions, many of which are ran via the engine of AI, to be able to automate tasks that humans certainly should not be doing. You know, it's interesting. Over the last several years, people started acting like robots. Have you noticed that? You go to the counter at the airlines, you go to the counter anywhere, and you're being talked to like a robot. I mean, literally, they're robots. But we humans like humans. And so I think that what we have to do, and the reason these counter people are robots is because they're also required to do everything else. They're overtaxed. So the future and the things that we need to look at to be chaotic change makers is how do we leverage things like robotic process automation to automate tasks? There was a study that was recently done by McKinsey and Company, and they found that 30%, think about that, 30% of the tasks that are being done right now in your organization could be automated with the black box of artificial intelligence. And you see great organizations rapidly adopting automation. And automation has its role in virtually every aspect of our business. So the first thing I'd like you to consider is the impact of robotic process automation. Now, as it relates to artificial intelligence, there's been a great deal of hype. You could argue that there isn't enough hype about AI, and then you could argue there's too much hype about AI. Where we are right now with language models are really interesting, but in many ways, incredibly limited. Remember that artificial intelligence is a black box that learns and thinks, but it only thinks and learns within the boundaries of the algorithms, In other words, it's told what to think. Well, we're going to change that in the next 5 to 10 years. We're going to start to see the artificial intelligent models or algorithms that are able to think about what to think about. When we get to that, it will be a game changer. I guess as it relates to this module, we could talk about lots of different things related to the changes in technology. But I think there are three things that I would like you to consider when you look at your expertise as a change maker. Number one, artificial intelligence is real. It matters to your business, and you need to develop core competency in understanding artificial intelligence. There's a great program that's available through MIT for leaders and executives on really understanding the business principles and how to apply them as it relates to AI. It's a time investment and a money investment, but their program is excellent. And there are, of course, other programs like the MIT program. I suggest that you develop core competency in artificial intelligence so that you can understand the nuances of the trajectory of change and how to plug these new solutions into your enterprise. Remember, we're going to use the black box of AI to automate tasks that should not be done by people. That's a very powerful way of reducing costs, but it can also have very positive impacts on the way in which we deliver friction-free, beautiful experiences to customers. Now, some people say, well, you know, I don't want the black box of artificial intelligence delivering customer experience. Well, I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. I wrote 2 best-selling books, What Customers Crave and What Customers Hate. I've been a global guru top 30 expert for 9 years in a row. I spent a lot of time in customer experience, and you can really use technology in a way that's productive. Let me just give you an example. The other day, I purchased a tile tracker. These are little electronic devices that you hook to your keychains and backpacks so you don't lose them. And I purchased it directly from the company. And when I got it, 2 of them worked and 1 of them didn't. And so I'm thinking, okay, here we go. I'm going to have to get on the phone with tech support, and they're going to spend about 45 minutes of time, which I don't have today, to walk me through the debugging of their tile tracker. And I'm sure you've had the experience of calling, your Wi-Fi's down, and they're telling you to reboot it and to press this and to enter that, only to tell you 45 minutes later that, yeah, it sounds like your wireless router's broken. For some reason, they make us go through being the tech support. But not so much. When we yet leverage artificial intelligence, we can understand how to deliver better experiences. In fact, there was a study that was recently done by the University of California at San Diego, and it found that the patient, the medical patient, preferred the interaction they had with the robot when compared to the interaction with the doctor. Yikes! That's pretty freaky, but that's the truth. We can be so good at this is that we can take the pain away from an engagement by leveraging hyperconnectivity, leveraging artificial intelligence and other tools. So I went to their website to get my tile replaced. I had the choice of making a phone call, hour of my time, or I could go on their chatbot. And I thought, let's give that a whirl because I really don't have a lot of time today. So I entered in to the chat box and I simply said, I bought one of your tiles and it's not working. The bot responded, it sounds like you've tried everything. I'm like, wait, usually that's an hour into a tech call before they utter the words, it sounds like you've tried everything. And so I simply responded, yeah, okay. And then literally in 2 seconds, it responded, I've already shipped you a new one. I'm like, what happened? I'm 6 seconds into this dialogue and it's already fixed my problem in 6 seconds. So I'm getting ready to write a 5-page love letter back to the robot. And before I had a chance to respond to the I've shipped it message, it said, pretty fast, huh? Oh my God. And it's arrogant. I love this robot. Look, we can use artificial intelligence and other tools in a humane way. We can eliminate friction. We can improve relevancy, personalization, all the things that we really want to do in the way in which we deliver experiences for customers by leveraging the technology. My only word of warning is use artificial intelligence for goodness instead of evil. And by that, I mean, let's not use the machine to punish customers, and let's not be impersonal, and let's not lose our human connection. But the beauty is that when you do this right, we can free our humans to be able to be human. We can let the robot do robotic tasks so that our people can deliver humanistic, loving, thoughtful engagements to partners, customers, and everybody that's in our experiential ecosystem. I love that. So, in conclusion, in module 2, what I'd like you to consider the three things that you need to pay attention to. Become, number one, become a change maker by understanding artificial intelligence. Understand it and understand its specific business application. And that's why I'm an advocate for the MIT and other programs that really show you the linkage between artificial intelligence and how it benefits businesses with really very specific recommendations on tools and resources. If you do that right, you'll be able to reduce costs by 30 or 40%. You'll be able to leverage your innovation pipeline to achieve strategic results that are as much as 40 to 60% better. I mean, the return on that investment to you is epic. So number one, become an AI and emerging technology expert. Number two, understand the principles of connection architecture. Now, connection architecture suggests that AI is interesting, but if it's not connected to something, it's completely useless. You know, we humans can smell, we can hear, we can taste, we can see, we can feel, right? We have inputs, we have data inputs. And then we aggregate in milliseconds the combination of all of these sensors that we have built into our human bodies, and we make decisions based on sensor data. What we're going to see is that we're going to see the internet of everything. We're going to see the AI of everything, or virtually everything is connected. And by making it connected, we can understand the meaning of disparate data signals to understand what we should do about them. We can understand the customer journey much better. We can understand the employee journey much better. We can begin to develop analytic and predictive models to understand how to be something that I widely suggest, and that is an anticipatory organization. Best organizations are anticipating the future, and they're way ahead of their competition. And let me just spend one more second on that. You know, if you look at a master chess player, and I mentioned this in my book, you know, you'll see that they're as much as 12 moves ahead in their mind of where they're going to move that chess piece to. 12, that's crazy, right? And when you look at people like Elon Musk, you know, they say that he's 10 to 12 moves in the industry that he lives in. He's 10 to 12 moves ahead of everybody else. So by developing an anticipatory enterprise, we are able to move farther down the line. Another really easy example I'd like to give is that imagine you're driving down the road in a dark mountain road. It's windy and there are no streetlights. It's midnight and it's literally pitch dark. You're getting ready to go into the turn, and all of a sudden, without warning, your headlights turn off. Well, what do? You stop. I mean, we're not going to go into the corner of a dark mountain road with no headlights. We stop. And since most leaders believe that the future is uncertain, they do something really bad. They stop. But remember, the future is not uncertain. It's just complicated. But complication is not a big deal, right? I mean, that's the stuff that innovation is made of. Who cares it's complicated? We'll figure it out. It's not uncertain. But for many leaders, understanding these principles in my book, Chaotic Change, they're very unclear on. And as a result of that, they're going to get their clock clean by leaders that are lucid. All right. So we talked about the impact of artificial intelligence and emerging technologies. We talked about the importance of understanding what to connect the black box to. But I also believe that the third component of technology is for us to build thoughtful and robust policies around these technologies. As we transition through the next 5 years, the genie will be let out of the bottle. Our organizations need to be really thoughtful and careful about the policies that we create to make certain that we're using these powerful tools in a way that respects and honors mankind and our friends and colleagues and employees and everyone. I mean, I think there's a big risk that this could go bad if we don't build out very early on thoughtful policies around technology in general. Okay, so there you go. That's what I would suggest as it relates to module two. Become an AI expert, understand the trajectory of change, understand connection architecture, and build thoughtful ethical strategies around your technologies. All right, let's go now to module three. I call this module hyper-consumerism because, well, we live in a time of hyper-consumerism. And it's interesting, what I have discovered, and I'm obsessed with customer experience, is that when you really think about it, anybody would realize that customer experience is an innovation discipline. Customer experience is an innovation discipline. And let me give you the definition of innovation. Innovation is the process of creating novel value that serves your organization and your customer. Sounds a lot like customer experience to me. So if it's an innovation activity, then we need to be much better the way in which we get insights. So let's start there. The biggest problem in the area of customer experience is we don't know our customers. We use promoter scores and customer surveys. I mean, the customer survey industrial complex is gigantic. And in my humble opinion, the data that they provide companies is lame. It's inconsistent, it's inaccurate, it's non-actionable, and it does not result in fixing anything. So if you're relying on customer surveys, chances are you don't know your customer. Let me give you a really quick example. My wife recently purchased a new car, and this has happened three times in my life. So she purchased a new car, we get a letter from one of the top consumer insight companies in the world. I'm not going to mention their names because I don't like to hurt people's feelings. And so in this was a request for me to fill out, or my wife, to spend 15 minutes filling out a form. Why would I do that? What's in it for me? I mean, I know that sounds hedonistic, but we're all, you know, time restraint. Why would I fill this out? I'm just not interested, right? So like most people, I didn't fill it out. So they send another one and another one and another one. And finally, they send one where in the corner of the window, there is a currency, like a real U.S. currency. Could it be $1 million? Or could it be a consulting fee of $1,000 for my time? Nope. That's not what's in the envelope. It's a dollar bill. So if it takes 15 minutes to fill this out, that means they're paying me at a rate of $4 an hour to give them free information that they turn around and sell for millions. That does not make any sense to me, right? So you could argue that the information that you get from that survey is always going to be wrong. People are just going to put down anything and send it in. Or they're going to be in one of the two major personas, people that really hate the car dealership and people that really love the car dealership. But the insights are in the juicy center, as we say. That's how the largest automotive manufacturers in the world are getting information about customer satisfaction. Or they're using something that I really don't believe in, and that's promoter scores. But the thing about these methods is they have become so institutionalized, the idea of doing something real to really understand what your customers think is just out of the question. So if we're not willing to co-create, collaborate, roll up our shirt sleeves and get out into the market to see what it really is like to experience our product or service, we will never, ever have the insights necessary. Let me give you one more really short example. Have you ever watched the TV show Undercover Boss? Well, if you haven't, Undercover Boss is where a CEO of a major company gets out of his corner office, puts on a disguise, and works on the front lines with their employee. And what they find is that, oh my God, we treat our employees like crap. We treat our customers even worse. This is a joke, but that never showed up on my survey radar. How could this be my company? It's carpet time. It's carpet time. Time to get on the carpet and experience the people that you serve every day if you're brave enough to do the right thing. This is what's required, is the ability to be able to get far better insights by real human interaction, by active observation, by customer satisfaction hackathons, by ideation sessions. All of these things really provide extremely, I mean, tens of millions of dollars have been created in these kinds of ideation sessions that go beyond creating beautiful little graphs and charts of erroneous information that you will never serve. I was once working with a major hospital system, and I wanted to look at their patient satisfaction data. Nobody knew where it was, but they did know that they were paying $7 million a year for the data. I'm like, how is that even possible? So finally, after 2 days, we found out that there was an area in the hospital where they retain these kinds of documents. It was literally in the basement. I go down there, blow the dust off this document that nobody ever even looked at, and virtually everything I saw in that document was completely and totally wrong. If we want to grow our business and we want to be chaotic change makers, we have to, absolutely have to, understand our customers. Now, here's a few things to think about. Most people, when they're trying to understand their customers, they break them down into market demography. In other words, they look at their customers based on age, gender, geographic location, socioeconomics, all the stuff that we learned in business school. You know what all that stuff means? Nothing. It means nothing. Because whether or not a customer likes you or doesn't like you has nothing to do with their market demography. So then what do we want to look at as we build out customer personas? It's really simple. What do they hate? And what do they love across the 5 touch points of their customer journey? That's it. Forget their age, gender, and all these other prejudicial ideas about personification of your customer. The only thing that you should be caring about is what do they hate and what do they love? We worked with a client, Fortune 500 client, and they were not even able to get permission to ask the question using the hate word. I think really they didn't want to know the answer. So we got to get better insights if we want to deliver better experiential innovations. Bottom line, chaotic change makers are breaking the mold, exiting the survey industrial ecosystem, and they're getting great insights to understand what their customers' baseline level of expectation is. Okay, now that I've used the term baseline level of expectation, let me describe it. The baseline level of expectation is what customers expect. And most organizations target what a customer expects. You go into Starbucks, you expect to wait in line for a few seconds, you expect to have a semi-friendly person take your order, and you expect to leave there with your coffee. You want the least amount of friction, you want personalization, and you want a product that you enjoy. Pretty simple. But unfortunately, using Starbucks as an example, and I love Starbucks, there's another company called Dutch Brothers Coffee, and they are amazing. Rather than delivering an experience at the baseline level of expectation, their experience is astonishing. You go in there, and everybody in that place is happy. They're laughing. They're kidding with you. They're fun. They remember your name, like literally remember your name. I went in there 3 months ago, came back 3 months later, and they remembered my name and what I did for a living. And they asked me, hey, are you traveling right now, Nick? Wow. It's an experience that's hard to describe. But they've built a culture that is unbelievable. If we sell experiences and products at the baseline level of expectation, we will be disrupted by innovators that go far above the customer's expectation across a range of hate-love personas throughout the five touch points of the customer journey. That is the bottom line. Now, in the research from my best-selling books, What Customers Crave and What Customers Hate, I have found some really interesting things that we have created the customer service and customer experience industrial complex. I mean, this is an industry that's saying the same stuff it was saying in the 1950s. We have a different consumer. We're in a time of hyper-consumerism. People want friction freedom. They want conspicuous value. They want personalization. They want it all. And we're going to leverage better strategies, better insights, and in some cases, far better technologies to make the experience astonishing. Customer experience has changed completely. And if you do not have an existing, updated CX strategy that's less than 6 months old, your strategy is outdated. If you don't have a CX strategy, period, that's directly bolted onto your enterprise strategy, you will fail. Guaranteed. Guaranteed. I know that sounds shocking, but it's true. Chaotic changemakers are experts at getting great insights about what customers hate and love across the five touch points of the customer journey, and they are constantly inventing new experiences and new products and services to go well above the customer's baseline level of expectation. All right, now before I leave this module, I do want to describe the journey really quickly. Your customer experiences you across five well-defined touch points. The first touch point is what we call the pre-touch point. It's a touch point where they're researching you. So if I'm going to research bagel shops in my area, and it comes up and this bagel shop has a 2-star review, the other has a 5-star review, I'm going to the website of the business that has the 5-star review, because we call these now the hyper-influential social communities. These communities decide who's good and bad, not the company. And usually the data is fairly accurate. So we can lean in on this community of customers to understand their experience, so we can kind of determine what our experience might be like. So you go to the website, and it is like Lemonade Insurance's website. Super simple. We got bagels. We're open this time. Here's a free coupon. Here's everything you need to know about the history of the bagel. It's a bagel. It's for people that want to quickly come in. There's not a bunch of sale. There's no sales. It's a value dispenser. The best websites are value dispensers, not digital brochures. And then when you walk in, it smells good. It looks good. People are friendly, right? That's the first touch point. And then as you're there, sitting there, you're still feeling the vibe. You're loving the food. Everything's great. That's the core experience. And then as you get ready to walk out the door, the person at the counter goes, "Hey, thanks for coming in. Hope to see you tomorrow." That's the last touch point. And then getting an opt-in email or text message saying, "Hey, we got a free bagel for you. Come and claim it at your convenience." Those are the five touch points. It's the way in which people research in the pre-touch moment. It's the impact of that very first moment and the first touch point, which determines about 80% of the way they're going to feel about you in perpetuity. And then there's the core experience. What's it like to do business with you? And then the last touch is, how do you leave them? How do you leave them? And then the fifth touch point is, how do you stay authentically connected in a way that delivers continuous value? If you want to learn more about how to architect a really, really thoughtful customer journey, check out my book, What Customers Crave or What Customers Hate. It's a big topic, and there's a lot to cover, probably more than we'll be able to cover in complete detail in this particular masterclass program. All right, let's quickly go to module 4, the new workforce and staffing. Okay. It is said that there are unemployed people and that there is talented people. but there are no unemployed, talented people. If you want to attract and keep mission-critical talent, you have to build a culture of enterprise happiness. Most organizations fail miserably at being purposeful and strategic about their cultural ether. But the good news is, and you can learn more from my book, Happy Work, we have discovered that there is a process. I've trained tens of thousands of people on employee happiness, tens of thousands on employee happiness and joy. And what I have found is that when you apply these principles, it works with mathematical certainty. I mean, really the biggest problem with organizations having a good culture that attracts great people that have great productivity is will. They're not that interested. They see their employee as a cost and as a potential enemy. They spend most of their time building out HR infrastructures designed to protect them from their own employees. And yet, we know that the incidents of workman's compensation, bad online reviews, they really come from cultures that are sick. It's not to say that there's not the anomaly out there that is going to, you know, behave in a way that is destructive to the enterprise. But if we build out workforce strategies from that perspective, we'll definitely fail. I think that the key thing to understand is that we know how to build a culture of happiness. Now, there's a few things that I'm going to recommend. One thing is that you build out what we call HAAS, happiness as a strategy. And the happiness strategy begins with better insights through employee happiness hackathons. Wow, I could do a four-hour talk just on the incredible results it gets when you put together formal happiness hackathons with employees. They'll tell you what you can fix in order to make their life better, and it's almost always free. And I will tell you, the net return on investment is off the charts. And I would say it's fundamental to your success. So the good news is that if we build out a good happiness as a strategy founded in good insights from collaborative ideation, from the use of innovation pipelines, from the use of other methods, then we'll definitely be able to create a far better culture that does what we need it to do. Because we need to attract and retain great talent, but we also need presenteeism and productivity. All of that comes from happiness. We also need to address the issues of consumerization. Of course, we can't do that. We can't deliver great experiences to customers if our employees hate their job. So here's the good news. It's not that hard. Now, there's a new body of work that I'm obsessed with, and it's called Human Experience Innovation, HXI, Human Experience Innovation. And it says, let's not look at customer experience, and let's not look at employee experience across two silos, which 99% of companies do. They have a person that kind of owns customer experience in marketing typically, and they have somebody that's associated with HR that owns employee satisfaction and quality of work life. The problem is that when they work independently, they don't work. When you do these independently, they don't work. So the key here is to build an initiative around human experience innovation that is sponsored by either the board of directors or the CEO so that you have the authority to do the things that you need to do to improve the quality of life there. Now, human experience innovation actually takes this a step further. We look at what we call the experiential ecosystem. What humans and entities do we as an organization deal with that we should improve the quality of the relationship? Well, for most organizations, that's vendors, that's strategic partners, it's our community, it's obviously our employees and our customers. But in your unique industry and in your organization, who are the other participants within the ecosystem? For an example, in healthcare, it includes payers, it includes providers, it includes the government and regulators. It includes so many, includes benefits managers at organizations. There's so many people involved in the experiential ecosystem, but we don't tend to be strategic and thoughtful about the way in which we create strategies to improve the experience. Now, you may be asking yourself, well, why would I care about if my vendor likes their experience with me? I got to tell you, we have been involved in so many programs where we've done vendor company ideation sessions where we found tremendous opportunities to benefit both the vendor and benefit the organization at the same time. And had we not had this HXI initiative, we would have never got those learnings, and it resulted in saving tons and tons of money. In fact, we just did a program that was audited by one of the top accounting firms, and it provided a $10.7 million return on their initiative. Human experience innovation provides the ability to create the equilibrium between the way in which you deliver experiences for customer while at the same time looking at the interplay between the way in which you engage your employees and stakeholders. All right, so what makes for an unhappy for a happy employee? What we have found from our research is that number one, they have to believe in your mission. So take some notes here. Number one, do your employees believe in your mission? Do they understand your mission? Do you communicate the human dynamic of your mission weekly? I mean, if you own an ambulance company, we're not in the business of charging people to send them to the hospital. We're in the business of delivering safe and efficacious emergent care that saves lives every day. That's a different articulation of the same thing. But employees don't care about making you rich. But they do care about their contribution to your company that has a mission that serves others. That chain and that connection is required in order for you to attract and retain employees. You've got to have a great mission. You got to communicate the human dynamic and the end user impact of that mission weekly, if not daily. And of course, in our human experience strategies, we always recommend to our clients that they build out a formal communication strategy with ways in which to engage their employees leveraging a variety of tools. All right. The second thing is, and this is important, the other day, ironically, I was at Starbucks and I saw a friend of mine that I've known for maybe 20 years. And he and his wife had been married for 17 years. And he looked kind of, you know, somber. And I said, "Hey, Mike, how you doing?" He goes, "Well, honestly, not great." I go, "Really, what's wrong?" "Well, I just got a divorce." I go, "Wait, you and Mary are divorced?" He goes, "Yeah." I go, "That's crazy. You were the best couple ever." He goes, "Yeah, but you know, for some reason, over the last 2 years, we just stopped growing. We just stopped growing. We felt like we were in some suspended, you know, life animation. We just weren't progressing together as individuals and as a couple." You know, it turns out that employees want their job to be the authorship of their own life evolution. They want to get smarter. They want to get better in every aspect of their life. What are you doing in your organization to allow them to participate, to use the uniqueness of themselves to move the enterprise forward? That's something that you really have to think about, because employees want to believe in your mission, and they also want to feel that they're getting better every day in every way by virtue of their job with your organization. We recommend to our clients that they build out a personal growth plan, which with each and every employee. These easy to develop programs, first of all, begin the process of helping you understand what growth looks like to that particular employee and what kind of resources that you can make available. If you don't help them evolve, if you don't support their own personal evolution, they will leave for somebody better. The other thing that's really important is that they have to feel like their work is a safe place. They have to feel like it's home, where they're loved and respected, and they're treated fairly. When we institutionalize these projects across the human experience innovation strategy, we wind up getting really tremendous results. And yes, it is a strategy, and yes, it's mechanized, and yes, it's sequential and so on. But once you build these out, you create the machinery to be able to support lots and lots of people. I mean, we work with clients that have 74,000 employees. We've done work with clients that have a half a billion employees. So it doesn't matter if you're a large organization or a micro business. Everybody has to feel like they believe in the mission, that the mission that they're serving is connected to their own personal talents and interests, that they're authoring their own self-evolution, that they're having positive impact in other people's lives. They're connecting value to other people. And then they have to feel loved and respected, and they basically need to feel like they're at home. The good news is this is all doable. Again, if you want more information about how to make that happen, my book, Happy Work, goes into a great deal more detail. All right, we're almost done here. We're going to move on to Module 5, The Innovation Mandate. A few years ago, I wrote a book called The Innovation Mandate. And the book argues that innovation is a mandate. Well, I had no idea that 2 years ago when I was writing that book that the mandate would be as big as it is today. So why is innovation a mandate, and what is innovation after all? Innovation is a mandate because we have to increase the velocity and the size of innovation within our organization. We have to increase the size and the velocity. So what does that mean? It means that in a time of incremental innovation, things were slow, and ultimately the nature of innovation was fairly small. Then about 30 years ago, we began the process of transitioning into what I call disruptive innovation. And this is when the size of innovation and change got really big and the velocity of change and innovation became very fast. And in fact, it's continued to accelerate over that 30-year period of disruptive innovation. Well, today, we're in a time of chaotic innovation. And chaotic innovation is amorphous, I mean, it doesn't take form easily like it used to. It's disparate. It's asymmetrical. It's complicated. And for some, it's hard. But unfortunately, we need to become innovation superstars if we're going to be a chaotic change maker. And that means we got to get better market insights, better cultural insights. We've got to get better insights across what our customers and employees really believe and what they love and hate, in order for us to be able to innovate across all of these various verticals. Now, in its most simple form, I believe there are two, essentially, some suggest there are as many as 10. I think for the purpose of this masterclass, there are really two types of innovations you should be thinking about. One is the bright, shiny object, and that's the service or the product we invent that we sell to the marketplace. The other innovation is enterprise innovation. And that's where we use the superpower of innovation to be able to get far better returns on strategy. Again, I'm saying it again. You can get 60% better returns on stated strategic priorities leveraging enterprise innovation. So innovation is something like AI that the best leaders have developed core competency in. You don't have to be, you know, a third degree black belt in innovation, but you certainly should be aware of the various elements of this discipline, because it will be such an important part of all that you do. All right, so let's talk about first the bright, shiny object innovation. Bright, shiny object innovation is the way in which you get better insights through some of the methods I've talked about before, and so that you can more quickly develop technologies and service products and get them to the market before the competition. It's just that simple. But the problem is that most innovation pipelines are very sluggish, and most innovation pipelines are risk-centric. Now, there's a common innovation evaluation tool called StageGate methods, and it's a good tool and it's served a lot of people for many years. The problem with it, in my opinion, is that it's really looking at innovation from the perspective of what could go wrong. And when an individual is afraid of losing their job because they invented the wrong thing, we tend to not invent anything. But remember, the fueling force of innovation is failure, right? So if we don't create safe places to innovate, we're never going to create better innovations before the competition. So we need better insights. We need the internal culture to build a safe place to innovate. We need to be able to really pull back a lot of the bureaucracy and risk centrism that we look at in the process of taking products to market. Because the biggest risk in the area of innovation is not inventing, not failing at innovation. And that is very important. Period. Also, I think that if you want to try to learn more about really how to bring all this together, I would suggest you read my book, Innovation Mandate, that really talks about this in more detail. But innovation is really, really clear and easy to understand once you lean into it. It's a very straightforward discipline. Now, let's talk about something I'm really excited about, and that's enterprise innovation. Now, enterprise innovation says, well, we need to reduce cost, we need to increase revenue, we need to attract better people, we need to improve productivity, we need to build our brand, we need to do all the things that we like to do with our organization. Well, in order to do that, we need better insights, and from those insights, they instruct better innovations, and then we need to develop what we call fast-track methods to be able to fast-track the innovations to the marketplace. That's the throughput. So enterprise innovation says, well, the best ideas are going to come from stakeholders that are seeing problems and seeing opportunities and seeing customers and seeing issues all day long. And so when you build out a enterprise innovation initiative, and we've done many of these, I suggest if you don't already have a center for innovation, that you develop one and use that center to be the warehouse for these tens of millions of dollars of ideas that are going to help your organization move forward. But what we do is the best way to do this is through what we call innovation challenges. Like, let's say you want to reduce cost. July's initiative is called the Waste Out Initiative. We're going to reach out to you, genius stakeholders, to try to find ways that we can reduce costs to be able to improve the way in which we do it. There's incentives, there's events involved. We use a thing called ESNs, Enterprise Social Networks. Those leverage gamification and social engagement to get more people to do it. I know, lots of buzzwords, lots of stuff here. I guess my point is that enterprise innovation should be one of a half a dozen key tools in the quiver of the best chaotic change makers in the world. Developing core competency in these modules that include the impact of technology, the impact of lucid leadership, the impact of hyperconsumerism, the impact of the new workforce, and of course, the impact of innovation. Those five verticals are something that you need to build competency on. Because that's where your success and your enterprise success is going to come from. So I think, again, you have to build an ecosystem of collaborative ideation. You want to collaborate with vendors and partners and customers. You need to move those innovations through what we call an innovation pipeline so we can quickly evaluate them and then move them towards deployment. Certainly, this is a 15-hour audio program to provide the detail necessary to really even begin the process to do this. But I think it would be incompetent for me not to begin the process of prompting your curiosity as it relates to building core competency in the area of innovation. Now, my book, Chaotic Change, we cover this in some detail, but we're covering all five of these pillars. So, you know, each one of them has as much detail as you can get in a 60,000-word book. So, you know, ultimately, the goal here is to start the inquiry because all of these need to be developed in a way that's really connected to the uniqueness of your culture, to your current state of what we call enterprise maturity. Because today, as you said, you're going to have a level of leadership maturity. That may be a 0 on a scale from 1 to 10, or it may be a 10. You're going to have that same level of enterprise maturity across consumerism, across workforce, across innovation, and across emerging technologies. So what we want to do is we want to get that core competency across these five verticals to at least an 8 or so, because that allows us to be able to compete very, very favorably. And I find that, you know, some organizations are actually really quite good at customer experience, but they may not be good at, say, innovation, or maybe they're good at innovation, but they're not good at creating cultures of happiness. And the list goes on and on. So the key is equilibrium. We have to be good at all of these. In the good old days, we could be okay at some, but in a time of chaotic change, chaotic change makers need to be good at everything. Look, I hope this masterclass gave you at least a primer into where we are heading in terms of the requirements to lead in a time of chaotic change. I'm always honored, genuinely honored, when people reach out to me to ask me more details and more questions. This is my happy place. I do this work because I love it, and I love the impact that I have been able to have over 40 years in my career. So by all means, if there's anything I can do to help you get better insights on these various things I talk to or steer you into other resources, by all means, do reach out. There will be a resource page that'll be on the nickwebb.com website, my speaking website. So if you navigate the website, you'll see that there is a place for books and there'll be a place for Chaotic Change. And then within that Chaotic Change page, you'll see downloadable resources and access to various things. Listen, I really appreciate the opportunity and I'm honored that you would take the time to listen to my humble thoughts. I really truly hope that this has provided you some great insights on how to be a chaotic change maker. Thanks so much.